Hello and welcome to this episode of the Symposium of the Lotus Eaters. I'm joined today by Harry.
Hello there.
And we are going to talk about the Republic of Cicero. Now, have you read the Republic of Cicero or parts of it?
I have now read parts of it. In preparation for this, you recommended that I focus primarily on book one, book three, five, and the Dream of Scipio, which were all very, very interesting. If I'd had more time, I would have read the whole thing. But sadly, as I discovered, we don't have the whole thing available in the first place. It was somewhat disappointing that whenever it really felt like one of the speeches that a character was giving in this was getting into the meat of the subject, that it would immediately go, 17 leaves are missing. We have an indeterminate number of leaves missing, which is just part of the chance of history that we've only got so much of this left, and it is disappointing. But what I have read of this now was fantastic, very enlightening. I thought the actual form of the discussions that they were having by having it in the dialogues was more engaging from a reader's perspective than have it, like you've said before, than have it be a pure treatise, just put down, here's what everything should be. And I think it is more natural to how we discuss philosophical ideas in the real life, in the real world, because it's very difficult to listen to any discussion where people are just dictating to one another what the ideal world should be rather than having a conversation with give and take. And once again, this is the first time I've read anything like a dialogue like this. First time I've read any Cicero. First time I've really read much from Roman times. And I'm a little bit of a Philistine in that manner, which is I'm not particularly familiar, other than some of the stuff that everybody knows, with Roman history. So you might have to guide me through a little bit of it as the discussion goes on. But it was really enlightening to get the opportunity to read something like this. So thank you for offering me the opportunity.
I'm glad you liked it. I don't think we will have to delve into the historical bits.
I think it's all pretty much there, yes, with the context and everything that particular, the Oxford edition gives anyway.
But yes, we are going to focus mostly on the philosophy of the dialogue. Now, one thing to say that Cicero was born in Arpinum around,
That's no problem.
Sorry, I missed this.
It's just in the beginning of it. Bear with us for a moment, ladies and gentlemen.
About 106 BC, which was a town around about 110 kilometers southeast of Rome. And he died in 43 BC. He had a very terrible ending.
Yes.
Nasty way to go.
He was assassinated, sadly.
Yes. So thing is that he was what was called a new man, the first member of his family to become a senator. And eventually he was elected to be the consul of Rome. I think there were two consuls in the period of the Roman Republic. And many people think that this was the highest position. But I think that it lasted for a limited amount of time. It wasn't for life. So the thing is that his finest hour was when he convinced the Roman Senate that Catalina was organizing to overthrow the Roman Republic. And his speeches are still preserved today. There are other editions where we have the political speeches of Cicero, and they are considered to be among the greatest speeches of antiquity.
I know that he has a reputation, even just from having not read him before, as a master rhetorician. That's kind of what I am most aware of him as being, as well as a political theorist or somebody who wrote dialogues. He was always known to me as somebody who reads Cicero so that you can master the art of argumentation.
Yes. And his example teaches us not to be an abysmal winner, because although he won, he asked for the death of Catalina, and that was something that wasn't particularly well received by other members of the Roman Senate, and they exiled him years afterwards.
He had a bad time reading the room.
Yes. He basically saved the Republic. He was credited as having saved the Republic, but he sort of was unconstitutional in the sense that he asked for the death of Catalina, and that was considered to be a sort of violation of the Roman constitution, and many people wanted him out. And to be frank, whenever there are people who are really good at talking and they have the ability to sway an audience. There are other people who are really fearful of that, and they think that, you know, maybe this person is dangerous and maybe we should do something about him.
Yes.
Let's say that he saved us and give him an honorary savior status, but we don't want him around.
Yeah, he's too dangerous to be kept around. That's interestingly, that is a subject which is covered very briefly of what we've got of this text in the Republic, where I forget who it was who said, but somebody was saying that it's actually better that somebody who's dishonest is more dishonest by just bribing people rather than through the ability to convince people, because you can, a dishonest man will accept bribes, but an honest man won't, whereas an honest man will be convinced by good argumentation. Perhaps Cicero was speaking from his own experience being the dishonest arguer in the past.
So he was exiled, and he was then restored back some years afterwards. And in those years of exile, he was writing philosophy, and he wrote the Republic and the Laws. And writing philosophy was sort of his consolation. We have two periods in Cicero, the early and the later period. The later period was involved a burst of creativity on all sorts of matters. One of the most famous texts is On the Nature of the Gods. And it was in the last 2 years of his life where his daughter died. And also there were very turbulent times back then. The history of that period is very tumultuous, or maybe that's the word. Turbulent.
From the timeline that was given, it was only a few years before he was assassinated, that Caesar crossed the Rubicon. So
yes. So eventually he was brought back from the exile, but then he wasn't particularly keen on the first triumvirate. That was with Julius Caesar, Crassus, and I think Magnus. And he thought that they were a danger to the constitution. And then he underestimated Octavian, and he spoke against Mark Antony. And at some point, Mark Antony asked for his death. Octavian gave his permission, let's say. And he was put to death in 43 BC by the execution hitmen of Mark Antony.
Yes, I was told that it was a noble death he was given, a sword through the neck, but still not a nice way to go.
Yeah.
Still, I'd prefer to go in my sleep if given the choice.
Okay, so what this teaches us, in a sense, is that when you win, you shouldn't be intoxicated by your victory. I think that this is a good lesson we can get from this.
This is something that you can learn in less high stakes circumstances as well. For instance, I've learned that people don't like a sore winner in playing pool and other such casual excursions. You don't have to be mean-spirited about your victories. People don't like that. In fact, there's more nobility in losing when the other person is mean-spirited in their victory a lot of the time.
You say, I take victory every time. Okay, so there is another terrible anecdote about his death. Maybe it's true. I'm not aware of whether this is just an anecdote or it is truth, but it is said that the wife of Mark Antony took out his head, because they did decapitate him, and they brought his head back to the Roman Senate as a means of
proving that he was dead.
And to make an example of him.
That makes sense.
Don't be eloquent and a good Republican like Cicero. That was the message. And it is said that the wife of Mark Antony took his tongue out, and she stuck a pin on it.
Sends quite a clear message there for those who would use their tongue for nefarious means, I imagine, is what it was supposed to be saying.
Or means that are perceived nefarious. Yeah. Okay, so the Republic and the Laws are the two dialogues that are considered to be his best ones and his most original ones. And they belong to the early period. We can start by saying some things about Cicero's philosophical commitments. So the first thing to say is that he thought that rhetoric was supremely important in all sorts of ways, one of which is personal development and also social progress. He thought that with his writings, he was bringing and preserving the best insights of Greek philosophy, and he was bringing them to a Roman audience. And he thought that this would contribute to better citizenship, because he thought that this way of thinking, philosophical way of thinking, when presented in a right manner, in a way that communicates and gets the point across, it can make people become better people and better citizens.
I would agree. So I would also say, adding on to that, in more recent years, there's been psychological studies done that demonstrate that the things, I mean, it's pretty clear and it's pretty self-evident, but some people do forget it, that just the things that you read and the knowledge that you take in through that changes your perception of the world and therefore changes your behavior as well. Like, for instance, there was a book where there was psychological studies done that were and behavioral studies done proving that the more you think like an economist, say like a Paul Krugman, or perhaps even a libertarian economist, you are going to be somebody who is going to behave more selfishly off the back of that, by because of the fact that your basis for analyzing the world is the idea of the economically rational actor as somebody making free decisions in their choices without having to be tied down to responsibilities or duties to anybody else. That will make you more selfish whether you recognize it or not. So I can definitely understand where that is. Whereas if you're going to be reading somebody who's talking more about ideas of duty and responsibility and kinship with one another, that will affect the way that you behave, and that will probably make you more responsible to how other people, to other people's needs.
It's very important to point this out, because there are many people, unfortunately, who think that, who are intellectualists. In what sense? In the sense that they think that they're just going to put forward an argument and it will just do all the work by itself. It will immediately convince people. I find this to be horribly mistaken. Anyway.
Do you have an example of anything like that, or even experience? I mean, obviously, you've done... was it assistant lecturer?
Yeah.
So
no, associate lecturer.
Yeah. Did you have any students that would just stand up and say, well, here's my argument, and just expect like one or two sentences to convince you on the spot?
Of course. The issue is also that it is not just students.
Oh, and the lecturers as well, I assume.
It's many people, because there is a tendency in society to say that, well, this is the right thing, and it should be blindingly obvious to everyone. And everyone who doesn't see this is a bigot.
I've been on the other end of those arguments before.
Yes. So what Cicero is doing well, and he's doing well by bringing into the Roman audience the method of Socrates, who could be said to be an intellectualist in that respect. He was a bit suspicious of rhetoric, at least as he's presented in the Gorgias of Plato. But what Cicero was doing is he was bringing those texts in the dialogue form to the Roman audience in order to, let's say, reveal the issue and make people think which alternative that is being put forward in those dialogues works best.
Sorry, I've just got an example that sprung to my mind of something that kind of exemplifies a lot of what you're discussing there, which was that in the past, I'm sure you've had similar arguments with leftists. Somebody who was a friend of mine, who isn't a friend of mine anymore for obvious reasons, she discovered that I was a bigot. Shocking. We were watching an episode of South Park, you know, the one where it's like, oh, they took our jobs and stuff like that. And in the process of that, I did bring up just briefly, like, well, all of these immigrants flooding is taking people's jobs, or at least it's flooding the labor market and depressing people's wages and such like that. And I don't think that we should be so accepting of just allowing illegal immigration in through the boats and whatnot. And my friend at the time, she just turned to me and said, what, do you think those people are illegal or something? People aren't illegal. And that is a very common leftist talking point in these days. And it's an example of very dishonest rhetoric, because it is reframing the conversation that instead of talking about the specifics of what's happening, these people are using illegal means means to breach the border, which they shouldn't be allowed to do because we're trying to protect our borders, etc., etc. And then when they're here, they're depressing the wages just through their presence in the labor market, etc. And it reframes it into, you think that their existence alone is criminal. It's the same way as when you talk back about trans lives and such, and they say, oh, this is trying to attempt transgenocide. This is all very, very dishonest rhetoric that, unless you are familiar with the arguments, for the most people on the street who don't often think too deeply about these subjects, it will catch them off guard. It will have the effect of emotionally manipulating them.
Exactly.
And in that way, will reframe their thoughts to make them second guess themselves. When they do try and think about things in a more honest way, they will probably second guess themselves and think, before thinking, am I getting to the truth here? They're going to think, am I being a bigot here? And that will have an emotional response built into them that will affect their thought process from that there on. So that's I think, an example of very, very dishonest rhetoric.
I have faced the same people with the same arguments. And I don't think that eventually you can have an argument with them.
No,
because they didn't constantly deny facts.
Yeah, it's purely about the dogmatic ideologue mode of thought that really does just put the blinkers on for anything that isn't within your frame of reference. It just means that it's wrong thing.
And there's an issue here with rhetoric, because rhetoric can be used for ill purposes. And that's when we, for instance, could name it sophistry. But there is a issue here that, for instance, there are some people who are really skeptical of rhetoric, and they just say, no, just focus on the argument and don't focus on being a good speaker. And they would, from their perspective, Cicero would be someone like Isildur in The Lord of the Rings. He would not throw the ring away. He would say, let
Elrond,
us use...
Standing at the edge of the plateau, yes, going, no, oh, don't mountain. Do it, throw it in the fire.
Yes, they would say that, no, stop thinking of this. Just throw it away. Cicero would say that this is wishful thinking.
I absolutely
there will
agree.
Be people in the public sphere who will use speech for bad purposes, and we cannot be a republic without facing that fear. And he wanted, and he was a staunch Republican, but we have to become good rhetoricians.
I absolutely agree with that, because at the end of the day, as much as we venerate, and Cicero himself, in, well, through some of the characters, puts forward the argument that reason should be above all. And I do agree that human emotions should be downplayed to some degree by reason, but that's something that's only really going to be able to be achieved by some of the great thinkers of our lifetime. Most people operate on a purely emotional level, and the ability of using rhetoric, of using effective argumentation, is to cut beyond anything and get to the emotional core of an argument. And if you want to be able to put forward an argument effectively, you're going to have it have an emotional impact on people, and to do so, you will need good rhetoric and good rhetorical skills to be able to do so. That's one of the things that made Trump so effective in his first campaign in 2015 through 2016, was the fact that he was taking these issues that really hit at the emotional core of what a lot of middle America was concerned about, and put them into very snappy, very simple, short sound bites. And that, whether it was intentional on his part or not, was excellent rhetoric. But I imagine that's a skill that he's developed over years and years and years of being a businessman. So he will have just naturally developed those skills in the process of selling people things. Whereas most people don't do such a thing.
I want to say something about this and tie it with Cicero and Aristotle, and go back to rhetoric nowadays. It seems to me that Cicero is following Aristotle in thinking that the requirements of a good orator are ethos, character, pathos, which is passion or emotion, and logos, which is reason. And he thought that you could you had to have all three. Of course, it depended on the audience, but in order to make a good speech, you need to have a combination of both. The precise mix depends on context, but he thought that was really
need to tailor a speech to your audience. But yes, I do agree that you need to be well developed in all three of those areas in your speaking skills to be able to put a point across effectively.
Yes, and the thing is that we have to say that Cicero is talking about the lost dialogues of Aristotle that he considered to be one of the finest specimens of writing.
And it's so depressing when I hear something like that, that it's just ancient knowledge, ancient art that we don't have access to anymore.
Yes, and this is really weird. If you have read any Aristotle, you will definitely ask yourself, what the hell is Cicero saying? Because Aristotle's writings, at least the ones that we have, they are not particularly good in a prosaic sense. They're good in terms of content, but they seem more to be like notes that were compiled for his lectures.
Yes, we were discussing this yesterday, that I imagine what they were. They were probably just lines that he wrote down for himself to remind himself of his position that he could present to his to his class, and then a discussion would go from there.
So if we take Cicero at face value, Aristotle did have dialogues in the way that Plato had. And one of the greatest orators of all time says that they were really beautiful in terms of prose, which is bittersweet. Because on the one hand, we say that, okay, Aristotle had also that prosaic sense into prosaic talent into him. But unfortunately, we won't be able to have access to them.
Yeah, it's one of those unfortunate facts of history that we've just lost those over the centuries.
If we are to translate these three elements into the, let's say, the politics of these decades, I think that Trump is, it's not so much that he had these three elements, ethos, pathos, and logos. It's just that he had, he found the right sentiment to express in very few words. So he was extremely laconic.
You could say that, I think, that does focus a bit on the pathos element, because there's a lot of passion put into it that really connects with an audience.
I think as really good speakers, this may be a bit, it may sound a bit banal, but I think Ronald Reagan and JFK were really good speakers in US. And Winston Churchill was an excellent speaker in the UK.
And there's a reason that we have compilations of Churchill's witty sayings, because he was very effective.
Yes, and you do see in Churchill, for instance, the combination of all three elements in the way that you don't see it in other politicians who may express the sentiment of the time without necessarily their speech being good in terms of rhetoric. That's a separate question as to whether it's good in terms of content. So back to Cicero's philosophical commitment. Cicero was really interested in academic skepticism. And that implies that he was something like a fallibilist, as we would say today. He thought that certainty was not possible, or at least he seems to have thought this. And he isn't so much in favor of all the positions he lays out in the Republic, wrote. And that is the thing, that when we have dialogues, we need to remember that the author does not necessarily endorse the views of the people who participate in the dialogue. It's the same thing with novels. If you read novels with many characters, not every character expresses the author's perspective.
Yeah, well, once again, that's why I enjoyed the dialogue format of this book, was the fact that it was more true to life in the way that we explore these ideas, and it did make for it to be more engaging. But that is a particularly bad tendency that we have in the modern era, is that people will read the actions or dialogue of a character being written by an author and assume intent and purpose from the author that is the intended message. That is what the author actually believes, which is just completely wrong.
Yes, and this is low resolution reading. It's like in Dostoevsky, for instance, in Brothers Karamazov, they say we have the Grand Inquisitor putting forward this view, so it's Dostoevsky's view. There are all sorts of characters in that novel, and as in every other novel. So the thing is that Cicero was not dogmatic in the sense that he did not think that certainty was possible. That's the epistemic notion of dogmatism instead of the negative notion that we assign today. And he was reacting against the dominant schools of his day, Epicureanism and Stoicism. And what is really important to note, and it shows a kind of not necessarily a double standard, but it was an issue of concern. Although he was not dogmatic, he was in a philosophical sense, he was definitely closer to the Stoic temperament in politics. And he did think that Epicureans were not particularly good citizens.
Now, I'm not entirely familiar with, is it Epicurus?
Yes.
Who was the man behind the Epicureans? But I'm aware of him being regarded as somebody who was a promoter of hedonism. Now, you've mentioned that that's not entirely accurate. Would you mind just painting a more accurate picture very briefly for me?
Yes. Okay. Whenever we encounter a word, whether it's in our language or in another language or in an ancient language, the thing we should ask is, what does the author mean? Because it is overwhelmingly likely that the sense will change across time. So the thing is that Epicurus was talking about pleasure as being a good, perhaps one of the highest goods. But he did not think that that involved debauchery. Criticisms of Epicurus focus on him as being an advocate of debauchery.
Which isn't entirely accurate.
No, he wasn't. If we pay close attention to his writings, we don't have a lot of them that survive, but there are some. He was advocating for a quiet life.
A life of quiet pleasure. Yeah. So would the pleasures have been more artistic pursuits or more thoughtful intellectual pursuits, perhaps?
To an extent, he thought that wisdom or Epicurean wisdom consists in meditating upon the Epicurean metaphysical doctrine and trying to use that doctrine in order to achieve a kind of tranquility or ataraxia, which implies the state of soul that has no turbulence. So he was someone that he constantly said that if you want to be happy, you need to have a garden, you need to have friends, you need to stay away from politics, you need to stay away as much as you can.
Away from politics, I can see that that's where Cicero, I assume, is coming at him from the attack position.
Yes. And what is important here to note is that the perception of Epicurus was somehow created by the Christian church that wanted to make an example of him because he was a materialist. So he was not a hedonist in the sense that he was an advocate of debauchery, but there is a really significant question as to whether a materialistic metaphysics leads, whether directly or indirectly, to a kind of degeneration of morals. So that's a separate question. But Epicurus himself was not a hedonist in the sense we just said before. So Cicero is a non-dogmatist, and he's reacting both against Epicurus and the Stoics. But he thought that the Stoic temperament is much better to sustain and protect the Roman Republic and the Constitution. Now, he lays forward this in the whole dialogue, and in the structure, at least what remains from it. So the thing is that we have a setting. The setting is the following. We have a number of people who come together to the house of Scipio.
Historical figures, from what the introduction said, that Cicero would have been very familiar with and would have interacted with people who may have been attendant at such a meeting. So he's presenting it as something that I was told this by one of the characters, perhaps Lilius. I forget which one exactly it was.
Yeah.
So it's presented as almost something that could have happened.
Yes. And the thing is that despite the fact that we do not have a large section of the text, it was said that less than a third is political, which is really interesting because it shows that in the mind of the people in antiquity, there is no compartmentalization. Politics is not just a discipline that you can study as we study nowadays in a university without studying ethics and physics and...
Well, that's the way that Aristotle presented it as well, that politics was just an essential part of social and ethical life rather than something that can be pushed off to the side, which once again is where I can see him disagreeing with Epicurus.
Yes. And you do see that he does think that Scipio is somehow the person we should listen to more.
I feel that he was using Scipio to voice his own opinions, or to a certain extent.
There's this question that whether what he thought philosophically to be the case was something that he thought was sufficient for public life. And this raises questions of honesty and the question of whether that was a white lie on his part.
Sorry, could you expand on that a little bit?
Yes.
Catch exactly what you meant by that.
It seems that on a philosophical level, he is a skeptic. Mm-hmm. But he did think that particular doctrines were far better to maintain society and the Roman Republic. And he seems to have advocated them more staunchly.
So he was advocating them almost in a utilitarian sense. Because they are better for the Roman Republic, because they present better outcomes for us, those are the ones that we should focus on, even if we can't be entirely sure of their certainty.
I would phrase it in the following way. He was sensitive to some consequentialist considerations, and he may have thought that this was necessary in order to preserve the Republic.
Well, I can understand how he came to that conclusion, given that he, as you mentioned, he was a statesman himself, so he would have to have very practical considerations in everything that he had done up to that point.
And one thing to say is that Cicero was trying to copy Plato's Republic as a format of a text. That is why, and he's open about it, and he was really fond of Plato. And there are surprising similarities in structure and in positions, but this doesn't mean that Cicero had nothing original to put forward. Plato was not well aware of the functioning of the Roman Republic. So we do see Cicero using the format of Plato's Republic in order to argue ultimately for a mixed constitution. Yes. And he does put Scipio say this, that he's in favor of the Roman constitution.
Yeah, he does go through, he goes through his defense of democracy, his defense of aristocracy and monarchy, and then he gives his, Scipio gives his ideal preferred would be a mixture of the three of those. I'm not entirely sure if it's perhaps part of the text that we've lost or if it's just the fact that I'm not, once again, that familiar with Roman history, certainly not as much as I should be, if I'm perfectly honest.
The same applies for me.
Was he basically just advocating for something that the Roman Republic already had, or was it something that wasn't in place at the time? Because if so, I would have liked that he would have potentially expanded a little bit more on what that would have looked like in practicality.
It was towards the end of the Roman Republic. I think the first emperor was Augustus in 27 BC. But Cicero was living through the end of the Republic, and he wanted to preserve the Republic as much as possible.
So he was arguing for a protection of somewhat of the status quo.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, that makes sense.
And unfortunately, he did not have his way. And Rome became an empire, and many people think that this led to its disintegration. Cicero was particularly focused on moral disintegration, and that is why he, in his speeches, also his legal and political speeches, he constantly talks about customs and how morals have disintegrated.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.